Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today, we're talking about another lesson in the 343 Masterclass, and that is surrounding possession-based soccer and why that sort of team development, that sort of methodology is the best to develop individual players, in addition to the obvious answer that it develops collective teams. I'm joined by Benny Rogers. We are taking this systematic approach on a weekly basis to deconstruct and talk a little bit more about the lessons in the masterclass. It's great for parents. It's great for coaches. It's great for basically the whole ecosystem to tune on in, you know, and as we say in the intro, every single time, elevate the level of discourse and help the practitioners. I won't belabor the point because in our opening salvo here, we have a good intro in and of itself. So here we go. Lots of gold nuggets per usual in this one. A quick reminder, parents, you can go to 343masterclass.com and hop on board, enroll right away. Just click on the crystal clear buttons there and you can register and get all the lessons, get all access to all the videos, all the audio, you name it, to better guide your player through this American soccer landscape, this complicated American soccer landscape. It doesn't have to be that way. And so this will help quite a bit. Coaches, 343coaching.com is where you want to go. And if you are coaching the little ones, that is 7v7coaching.com. All right, let's jump into the episode. Good morning. All right, man. Do you like this plan of just doing a weekly 343 masterclass sort of thing where we're going through all the lessons? Obviously, for folks who want to join, there's a whole bunch more content in there. You actually get to see the videos. You actually get to see all the complimentary executable sort of things versus an audio or a video podcast that we're doing now. So that's the idea, Ben, is to do it on a weekly basis. And I think there's a lot of lessons that parents can learn and also coaches can learn too with regards to coaching, because what we're trying to do is teach the parents a few things. One is, what is good coaching? What is mediocre coaching? What is poor coaching? Because obviously that's hugely important for their kids and for them to be able to identify it. And number two is teaching the parents also kind of how to coach themselves. They might not coach a full-fledged team with their kid, but they can coach their kid on the ride to the game, or coach their kid on the ride home, or coach their kid at home, or maybe even personal train them and do all these sorts of things, or watching a game together and being able to point out subtleties that true practitioners know of and not necessarily just fans or just spectators or parents if they aren't, you know, footballers themselves. So I think that's a great service. And I think there's a lot of value for coaches and parents alike. And even if there's media people, well, I know there's media people who follow us. I think the media can learn a thing or two as well, in my opinion. And lastly, it helps us further refine and flesh out a lot of detail that doesn't really get lost. But when you write an essay or when you write a 1,000-word piece of content to teach a particular type of thing, it's very dense, Benny, if you know what I mean by that word, versus when we're having an informal chat between you and I, you can get a lot of gold nuggets that may not be in the writing itself. So I don't know if you want to react to that, but that's the thought process.
Right. So two things I'll add to that. One, I think maybe a lot of the questions that I would be asking you, I think a lot of other parents might have as well. And two, the other thing is, yeah, if you're on the fence about joining the masterclass or maybe you want to get more information, I think these weekly chats will be really helpful for you, right? Because you can really dive deep into the lessons as to what is being taught and what we are offering to you. So today, Gary, you know, moving on to the lessons, we wanted to talk about possession soccer. And the lesson actually is titled Possession Soccer is the Way. And so obviously 343 and Brian's early teams were pretty monumental in bringing possession soccer into the US. I think a lot of people before Brian believed that it couldn't be done here in the States. And it was kind of foreign to only European countries, Spain, Germany, all those countries. But I'll start with a simple question. Why do you think that historically possession soccer has been undervalued in the US?
So I think it's a matter of education, Ben. It's not that soccer hasn't been here for a very long time, how it's been everywhere else. It's been here for well over 100 years as well, no matter what MLS tries to convince you to think otherwise. But it has not been, it hasn't dug deep down into the American soul, if you will. It's lived with the immigrants for sure, and we are a land of immigrants. But if you kind of grew up in a household where it was American football, basketball, hockey, baseball, all of those sorts of things, well, there's a lack of education from a soccer perspective. And guess what? A lot of kids who started playing soccer had coaches who didn't have that soccer culture per se. And even if they did have the soccer culture, it may not be as deep and as sophisticated as, let's say, the very well-developed soccer nations are. And so what did the kids get and what exposure did the parents get throughout the past decades? It was a lot of ignorance, if I may say that word. And so if you had an American football coach as your soccer coach, kind of like how I did in high school, it was literally the American football, the gridiron coach was my soccer coach in high school. What did he value? Well, in that sport, it was big, fast, and strong. So guess what? Do you think he had any idea 30 years ago about playing out of the back, about rondos or losing your man, or, you know, pattern play when it comes to soccer? No, he knew big, fast, and strong. Kick it to our fast guys up front as soon as you can. And don't worry, they'll outrun their defenders and score a goal. So I think that at scale is what we saw in the United States at the youth level, at the college level, and at the professional level. And once it kind of got established that that is soccer, then guess what? The people in influential positions, they selected coaches and they selected players and all the selection process was based on big, fast, and strong. And guess what? There was also no real international competition at that point for youth or college or even pro for that matter. So you never really got exposed as doing things incorrectly. Your competition was all local, regional, national here in the States, and everybody was basically doing the same thing. And so nobody really got exposed from that. Who would actually win the games at the youth, college, and pro level? Well, the coaches and the staffs and the clubs that would select the fastest, the strongest, and the biggest soccer players. Everybody was doing it, but you know, somebody does it better than the others. And so we got really good at identifying that player profile. And so when, you know, if we fast forward now to when Brian came on the scene, and I'm not saying it was exclusively Brian or there weren't people before Brian, but the thing that was particularly unique about Brian is he was here in Southern California, the most competitive youth soccer scene in the country by far. And he was able to mop the floor with the entire competition with not so fast, not so big, not so strong players, and just run everybody over by playing, you know, FC Barcelona's possession-based soccer during Pep Guardiola's era. And that's a whole other story we can inject into the storyline here, of course, but that drew a shit ton of eyeballs. And, you know, we had the fortune also of, we had this nascent internet era in the 2000s or late, you know, 2010, 2011, 2012. And so obviously that helps distribute, you know, via video, via audio, via written copy, distribute the message, distribute the work that was being done to a national, international scale. And then all of a sudden, you know, we had this outgrowth of everybody wanting to learn how to do this and then obviously develop players using this methodology, which was the gold standard methodology across the world.
So Gary, I'm assuming you and Brad went to the same high school. So growing up, I'm sure you guys had the same coaches, right? That same American football type coach. And this is something that you mentioned before in previous podcasts. It's like the education that you and Brian got was from watching national team games or going to the World Cup to watch Argentina. So where do you think Brian drew most of his influence from?
I think most of it is from the Argentine national team and the Argentine first division, because obviously we would tune into River Plate, Boca, Vélez Sarsfield, Independiente, Racing. Like, we tuned into first division Argentine football, and it wasn't like possession based as we all think of, like Pep Guardiola at Barcelona or Pep Guardiola at Man City. It wasn't like that. but it absolutely was not kick and chase like it was here in the United States. They actually did connect passes. They actually did understand things at a much deeper level than just kick it to the fast guy up front. And so I think that was hugely influential. And obviously watching the Argentine national team, which did a lot of the same things. Hold on to the ball. Don't gift the ball. Don't make it a 50-50 back and forth punching match. It's you want the ball more of the time. And that was a basic principle of play. And obviously, you know, fast forward a little bit more, Marcelo Bielsa's Argentina was very revolutionary in a whole bunch of ways. And fast forward a little bit more, and then you have Pep Guardiola on the scene. And fast forward, you know, during that era, Brian is actually getting internships at FC Barcelona itself and learning directly from them during those golden years. And again, I'm talking 15 years ago, Benny, this was happening. And, you know, you put all of that together with the Argentine heritage that we have as well. And you have all the, and Brian's exceptional way of communicating with players and, you know, having that level of empathy and warmth, and, but also being able to be strict and execute, you know, have the players go 110% every single time, put all of those ingredients in the box, and then out comes the magic, so to speak.
So now there's been a huge shift in the landscape. It seems like everybody in youth soccer these days, they say they, you know, we want to play possession soccer. We want to build out of the back. You see teams trying to execute it. Some teams better than others. But for you, Gary, how do you really define success for a coach that says he wants to have a possession-based team beyond just winning games? Obviously, we know that winning is important. And it is important to have that philosophy or have your identity as a coach, especially if you say, hey, I want my team to play possession soccer. How do you define success from that team? Is it, do they have to win every game? Or what do you think? Let's start with the youth levels. So you've mentioned before your earliest experiences, you know, U8, U9, at that level, what is a successful team in terms of possession soccer?
Yeah, well, it depends what level you're currently at and what stage of development you're currently at. So that bar of success is constantly changing, and hopefully it's constantly getting higher and higher, right? The bar for success. So if you're starting at the very lowest of levels and you want your team to play possession, first and foremost, I want everybody to understand that this, I mean, I'll die on this hill because, I mean, I have all this history, experience, so on and so forth. This is the best way to develop individual players. But let's set that aside for the time being. You asked about a successful possession-based team. So if you're starting at the very lowest of levels, I think the coach and the players are in luck because the probability of being successful at this style of play, this developmental methodology, is a lot higher because you're playing against other teams and players who are also at the lowest of levels, okay? And so your opponents aren't very sophisticated at that point. And the chances are that maybe the opposing coach or coaches aren't as sophisticated either. And so just taking this methodology or this path, you can make massive strides and massive improvements right away. So what does that look like? Okay. Well, what it looks like is the number of passes that are connected per possession is a nice metric to kind of keep an eye on. So if you inherit a team that has a maximum of 2 or 3 passes per possession. Well, if you are able to crank that up to maybe 5 passes per possession, and maybe once in the entire game, you have a sequence that is 8 or 10 passes in a possession, that is already a marked success. Okay. Now, obviously, the ingredient here is being competitive and being able to win because some of the opponents of possession soccer here in the States, which we can dive into why they oppose it, but I think we've covered it elsewhere, or we'll table that for some other time. They'll say, well, it has to be possession with a purpose. Otherwise, it's useless and it's dumb or whatever. And a couple of things. One, from a developmental perspective, it's almost never useless. And you don't necessarily have to have more of a purpose than actually connecting the 5 passes or the 7 passes because you're teaching the kids, because you pose 8, 9, 10-year-olds at this point, Benny, you're teaching those youngest of kids to actually be able to learn and understand how to possess the football as a team. So that is the purpose at that point. The purpose isn't to, oh, let's be direct and insightful at some point and go score a goal. Yes, we want to do that. And that's part of the teaching process. But in and of itself, connecting the 5 to 7 passes when you're first starting out and first teaching the kids, that is the purpose of it, which is great. So I'll pause there. But obviously, the metric or the measure of success changes as you go up the age groups and as you go up the competitive levels.
Yeah, maybe you can expand more on an earlier comment that you made, like how possession soccer develops individual players. Because I think a lot of the opponents of possession soccer, they may say, oh, you're killing the kid's creativity. You're forcing him to do this, or you're giving him less time on the ball to go in attacking 1v1 moments. So in your view, how does a possession-based team, how does that develop the individual player?
Yeah, well, number one, first and foremost, we need to acknowledge that being able to possess the ball as a team is part of the game. It is a fundamental principle of the game. That's first and foremost, okay? So if you are neglecting that or ignoring that or minimizing that, you actually are not teaching the players how to play football, okay? And football is a team sport. That's one thing. The other thing is, you don't have to be so strict about things like, oh, my left back always needs to connect a pass and never should dribble. That's nonsense. Nobody teaches that. Nobody wants that. You just want to teach them, hey, identify the moments when you should retain possession and obviously teach them how to do that, and identify the moments when you should dribble and attack and try, you know, fancy things or do cool things. As an extreme case, just to make the point, you don't tell the kid or you don't let the kid be inside the 6-yard box in the goalie area, you know, or in the 18-yard box and try a rainbow or try a step over or try to meg somebody or try to dribble by 3 guys just because he wants to do it. You know, no, you correct the player. You say, hey, that is not the place to be doing those sorts of things. Now, do you punish him if they actually do that? No, but you know, you tell them, hey, that's not the smartest thing to be doing. That's not how we play. If you're in the middle of the field or if you're in the attacking third or something, maybe that's also inappropriate because you had your striker wide open and you should have made a pass or maybe you had 2 or 3 people on you and you shouldn't have dribbled by them. But that is the area where you do want to have some liberty or offer some liberty and let the kids experiment a little bit, of course. So it's a false dichotomy, Benny, when people say, oh, you're killing the kids' creativity. No, nonsense. We can do it all. That's another comment. And then lastly, before I hand the mic over, if you are capable and end up developing a possession-based team, it gives you so much more control and so many more opportunities for the players to actually be creative and express themselves versus just 50-50, launch it forward, and then the other team launches it back. And then you launch it forward, and they launch it. It's just chaos ball at that point. And so how many opportunities is any particular player actually going to have to try stuff? So, I mean, there's so much to discuss there and unpack there, but that's the basic gist of it. There is no killing of creativity. There is no killing of the development of dribbling or the development of all of these other components that comprise a good soccer player. It enhances it.
Yeah. And a big thing, Gary, is for the coach to ensure that the players have kind of situational awareness. If I can share a story from my time as a player with Brian, this is maybe my second game on the team with him. And I think maybe 10 minutes left in the game and we're losing 1-0. And I believe in that game, I was playing the 10. And there was a moment I got the ball. There was probably a through ball that I could have played, but I decided to, you know, go back and keep possession. And I remember Brian like being so pissed, like, Benny, like in the game, I was like, well, what is he mad about? I kept possession, right? But then after the game, he had like a 10-minute chat with me. He's like, hey, listen, like, one, if there's 10 minutes left in the game and we're losing, you need to have the mindset to be going forward, right? And so I think some coaches, maybe they overemphasize just, hey, keep the ball, keep possession, right? But they're sometimes lacking in letting the players know, like, you need to have that situational awareness. If you're losing the game, you need to create chances, you need to go forward, you need to take risks sometimes. So part of it is educating the players to let them know, like, you're going to make mistakes. If you're playing in a possession-based team, you know, no team in the world ever completes 100% of the passes in the game. But sometimes you do have to take those risks and go forward and create chances for your team. So for me, that was like a lifelong lesson that I learned. It's like, all right, now I know if my team is losing, maybe I do need to take a bigger risk to play that through ball or to drive at a defender and make something happen.
Yeah. And Benny, you remember Jacob Barone, right?
Super phenom.
Yeah, he was a super phenom, but I would get so furious at Jacob because Jacob, like 99% of the time, just wanted to keep possession. He played defensive midfielder, okay? So that is a big part of the role. But like your example illustrates, there were so many instances where he had oceans of space in front of him to just turn and drive forward, you know, and cause chaos and do damage to the opponent. And he would just like knock it to the left mid or the right mid or go back to the center back. I would blow up on him. And over the course of time, he would get a little bit better and better and better. But that was all, that was like in his DNA to just like keep the ball and not risk anything. I'm like, Jacob, fucking move the ball. Go forward, man. You know? So to be clear, for coaches out there and parents out there, we're not advocating keep the ball at all costs. Absolutely not. It's you keep the ball to have a structure, to play, quote unquote, the right way. But you have to identify the moments to attack or to even not keep the ball. If you're under massive amounts of pressure and you're 18 or something and it's hard, you don't have options, you know how to get out. Yeah, kick the ball forward. Absolutely. Kick it and kick the shit out of it out of bounds. Of course. Okay. What we're advocating for is a shift in this mindset away from big, fast, strong chaos jungle ball towards more organized, structured, disciplined, team-oriented, individual player development, all the positive things that you can throw at it. That is what we're trying to orient you in, the gold standard of global football and the gold standard of player development. That's all. And there's a lot of confusion out there in the marketplace, unfortunately, because many coaches don't know how to do that necessarily, or they've invested so much of their life energy into not doing that, not doing possession, not learning it, that they don't learn it and they don't want to learn it. And, you know, the marketplace is shifting towards, hey, like, why are you just doing kick and chase here? And they hate it, you know, because it's basically an affront to what they've been doing for so many years. And so they'll go on social media or whatever and kind of overtly or covertly try to undermine how it is that players should be taught and how it is that teams should be developed and how it is that coaches should be developed. It's really unfortunate because the ones that end up suffering are not only themselves, yeah, but the kids end up suffering and the parents and the media who regurgitate things that aren't true.
So Gary, it might be helpful because I think a lot of parents, especially if you're just finding out about 3-4-3 or your son is just starting, son or daughter is still, you know, they're new in soccer. I'm sure the parents maybe never played in their life. They hear the term possession soccer and it sounds simple, right? You keep the ball for your team. When you don't have the ball, you work to win it back. But maybe we can, you know, take a microscope and dive deeper. What do you think are the key principles of possession soccer that every coach and parent and player should understand?
So I'm going to say a phrase here, and it's a cliche because everybody says it, but it's needed. Time and space, okay? You need to understand time and space. And so let's dissect that a little bit more. First and foremost, space is the most important one, okay? Even though they're linked. You have to teach the players and the collective how to create space. So when you have the ball, the whole team should open up wide and increase the space between your own players. And that's very important because it makes it so much more difficult for your opponent to mark you and for your opponent to take the ball away from you. Because all of a sudden, you can't have one player who is on the opposing side basically covering two or three players of yours if you've opened up so much space. So that's number one. And there's a whole bunch of teaching moments as to how to actually do that. Because at the individual level, you should be aware of your immediate surroundings and find the little plot of land, right, that kind of optimizes the maximum distance between you and your opponents. So there's ways that we teach this, obviously. The back four, you can take them in units. There's the back four if you're playing 11v11. If you're playing 7v7 or 9v9, obviously it's a back three or a back two. The principle is the same. But you take the back four, you know, you spread them apart. You teach them how to create the right angles. You teach them the decision-making of whether you should go to the center back or the outside back or touch your defensive mid, all your options, you know, are laid out in front of you. And then you rehearse it, Benny, over and over and over again without any pressure whatsoever, just again, the flow. And then you throw in maybe one player to press a little bit, and then you throw in two, and then you're in a full game sort of situation. So that's one of the main principles, is teaching space, opening up. And then the other one that's intimately connected is time. So if you have maximized your space, guess what? When you actually receive a pass or get the ball, you're going to have more time before the opponent closes you down, and more time to control the ball, and more time to assess your options, which you should have already done before receiving the ball, but that's another topic. You just get more time. And with more time, you're able to then execute your next action. So those two things is where I would start off for people to begin thinking about the basic principle of possession.
Right. And something that you mentioned, knowing what you're going to do before you get the ball, right? Awareness, a lesson that I took from Brian that I try and influence to all my teams is, because you see it a lot, right? Maybe the left winger has the ball, and so the right winger is kind of checked out, looking around, or maybe just ball watching. But instead, right, they should be scanning the field, looking at their options. And that way, when they get the ball, they already know what they're going to do with it, versus you get the ball and then you look for your options, right? So I think for parents especially, and even coaches helping their teams, like for your players to have awareness, it's so necessary if you want to play that position-based style. Because if not, if every single player on your team is ball watching, there's just no possibility that you're going to be able to maintain possession. And having awareness is not easy to do, especially when you're a 7-year-old kid or 8-year-old kid. You know how long their attention span is. And obviously, okay, when they're that young, they want to just watch the ball. They want to see what's happening. So it's hard for them at those young ages to be scanning, like thinking in their head, all right, what am I going to do if the ball gets pinged to me right now? Am I going to do a quick combo with the 10 and get in behind, or am I going to take on this player 1v1? So I think that's one of the most important things for, especially for the individuals, to have that awareness before you get the ball.
1,000,000%, Benny. I couldn't have said it better myself. And here, we won't talk about this today, but here's where joystick coaching is very important, actually. And parents should look towards coaches who do joystick, but do it correctly and properly. Okay, there's a good way and there's a bad way. There's people who know how to do it. There's people who have no idea how to do it. I'll illustrate with one simple example. Let's take your left winger in your example. Okay, let's say your left winger is on the sideline where the coach happens to be, and the ball is on the other side of the field, you know, not even remotely close to the left winger. Here's a good opportunity for you as a coach, or for you to observe your kid's coach, for them to say to the left winger, hey, Jackson, take a look around, you know, hey, what are you going to do? If you got the ball right now, what would you do? You know, just coach them while the ball's on the other side of the field. Coach them, hey, what are your options? What do you think you're going to do if you get the ball right now? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just one little instance of joysticking, if you will. One benign instance that everybody should be doing. Benny, and it changes, you know, this awareness that you talk about, this critical awareness, it changes with level. So the higher the level, the more awareness you need, because the less space and time you are going to have. So if you're playing U10, you need awareness, okay? But at U15, at the highest levels, you need way more awareness. You definitely need to know exactly what you're going to do before you get the ball. Otherwise, you probably won't have enough space or time to actually execute your next action. And obviously, at the pro level, it gets even crazier than that. You can't just be thinking about one step ahead. You have to be thinking about three passes before things happen. You have to be thinking about the future. You have to be thinking about what is going to happen 5 seconds into the future, not just 3 seconds into the future, not just 1 second into the future. So I think at the U9, U10 level, yeah, you want them to think about that one action into the future. U14, U15, you have to maybe be thinking about two or three actions into the future. And then at the pro level, you know, don't take it from me, take it from all the testimonials of the highest level pros who've ever played the game. They're like, hey, the best guys are the guys who can see the future 5 steps ahead of you.
Yeah. And even if you go on YouTube and you watch some of Brian's old games, or and you can hear him coaching on the sideline, you see that happen. You see the center back have the ball, or let's say the left center back has the ball, and and Brian's talking to the right back. It's at the time, Shushu, whatever. It's Shushu starts scanning, and sure enough, Shushu scans, he looks, the ball comes to him, and he already has his decision in his head. So it's amazing to see. But so you mentioned that's a good way of joystick coaching, but what would be the improper way or a negative way of joystick coaching?
I think it principally comes down to whether the coach actually knows what he's talking about, if I'm being honest, because sometimes it's also good to joystick when the player is actually already on the ball. Let's say you said Shushu, right? His name's John Hilton, his real name. Brian had him from U9 to whatever it is up until he moved to Europe at this point. He's playing in the first division of Holland at this point. He's a 2002 born, so he's about to turn 23 years old, and maybe he already turned 23 or 22 rather. So he's off doing his professional playing career in Europe. But even if Shushu had the ball at 10 years of age or 12 years of age or 15 years of age, and it's okay if you know what you're talking about to say, hey, Shushu, look at Misa up top, you know, launch it now. Or, hey, Shushu, relax, touch it back to Mikey as the center back. Or it's okay to do those things so long as the player understands why you're doing it, is receptive, and there's this whole context around it, right? Maybe Brian at halftime had a game plan, right? And the game plan was, let's preserve our 2-1 victory, you know, our lead or something. So let's not be in a rush to give the ball away. So he might encourage Shushu to, hey, just give it back to the center back. Let's hold on to it because they're not pressing us. Let them come to us. So that kind of joysticking is quote unquote good joysticking. Another thing of good joysticking is not always doing it. Okay. It's context dependent, teaching moment dependent. And then the bad version is the classic caricature of the coach who is always screaming on the sidelines, trying to control every single action that happens with every single play. So the right back has the ball, he's yelling at the right back. The center back has the ball, he's yelling at the center back. Then the center back plays the D-mid, he's yelling at the D-mid. So he's basically a play-by-play announcer. That is the bad sort of joystick coaching, which should be avoided.
Yeah, I see it a lot in the youth game. Something that's negative about that too is like, okay, the right back has the ball and the coach, you know, maybe he saw earlier that the 10 was open, but as soon as the right back gets the ball, he says, hey, hit it to the 10. And then the right back looks up, he sees the 10, he plays it. And by that point, it's already way too late, you know? So that's a super negative thing that I see all the time. But I love how we talked about, you know, giving instructions to other players off the ball, meaning like, hey, left back, have awareness or start scanning or look ahead, right? And I think that just helps the flow of the game so much more. We talked about awareness as a good trait or quality for a player in a possession-based system. What other traits do you look for?
Well, you need technique, obviously. You have to have good technique. And then there's positional sort of requirements. You don't want to have the player on the team with the worst technique playing central midfield, for example, because the central midfielder has less time and space than almost all other positions on the field, because the central midfielder is surrounded by opponents and the central midfielder has to evade maybe on the dribble, the immediate pressure, or has to do a whole bunch of technical things to actually retain possession and then connect their next pass or whatever action that they're going to do. So that's one thing from a positional perspective. You know, a center back doesn't have to have the best technique on the team, because center back in a possession-based setup will usually have more time and space than every other player on the field. And actually, that's not true. The goalkeeper will have more time and space than every other player on the field for the most part. So the goalkeeper doesn't have to have the best technique on the roster or in the world or period, but they do have to have a sufficient technique to stop the ball and release it with an appropriate amount of time. So technical quality, Benny, for sure. And then we can go position by position as to what that looks like. But I think that's the subject of other lessons in the masterclass.
Yeah, and I think that's a challenge, Gary, that a lot of coaches are facing, is that, you know, maybe you have 75% or 80% of your team who are technically proficient and are able to keep the ball under pressure. But then you have that, you know, bottom 15% of your roster where it seems like every single time the ball comes to them, they have a brick of a foot. It's a, you know, their first touch is 5 yards away for them, and it's, you know, it's turnover every single time they get the ball, you know? And so that's why I stress as much as I can to my players, like, look, training 2 times a week or 3 times a week with the team is not going to be enough for you to be technically proficient. If you feel like you're the guy that always loses the ball for the team, you know, maybe they have a good understanding of the game and they have the right ideas, but if your technical ability is not there, it's impossible for you to keep possession. So how would you recommend that coaches go about those situations? Because, you know, I think that's something that a lot of coaches are having difficulty with.
Yeah, it is a challenge. Well, firstly, another myth that's out there in the wild associated with teaching possession-based football is that technical quality is being kind of ignored in training and in with the coaches, and that's not true at all. You incorporate technique building exercises in training for sure, but what those technique building exercises look like may not be what parents principally think of. So for instance, it's not juggling, it's not dribbling through cones all the time, even though you can incorporate a little flavor, a sprinkle of that for sure, but it's principally surrounding rondos. Okay. So rondos, you can, when you upload this video, Benny, or maybe we can read a whole description of rondos, the very, you know, small sided possession based games that develop technique, receiving appropriately with the inside of your foot, receiving it in such a way that you can release your next pass as quickly as possible and as calmly as possible. So the fundamentals of technique are being developed in rondos in training. And you have to do that as a coach if you also want to have a possession-based team and have the possession-based team getting better and better and better. And if you do have that bottom 15% of the roster, like you said, who is not technically good, Benny, then in the rondos, they're going to get better over time. But it might take them 6 months or a year or 18 months or 2 years if they don't do individual homework by themselves. You know, if they're not doing anything outside of the training environment, then man, they're perpetually going to be behind and they're perpetually going to be stuck in that bottom 15% of the roster. And then yes, in many cases, they could be a liability to a team that is trying to be a possession-based team. There's no question about it. You know, it reminds me of Bruce Arena, good old Bruce Arena. You know, I've thrown my darts at Bruce over the years. You know, the winningest coach, I think he's the winningest coach in American soccer history, or maybe it was Siggy Schmidt. I don't exactly remember, but he gave a phrase maybe 15 years ago or 10 years ago, I don't recall, that, oh, well, we can't do this possession-based things that, you know, the Europeans do here in the States because, you know, we have black holes on the team. He literally called what you were calling the bottom 15%, he was calling them black holes. In other words, the ball comes to them and then the ball disappears, you know, never to be seen again at that point. But it could be a function of a coach not knowing how to, A, either get that player to improve or get that player in a better situation so that they're not a black hole. For example, maybe the coach is not teaching appropriate spacing for the team, you know? And so if you're not teaching appropriate spacing, then guess what? That black hole has less space and time on the ball. And then since they already have bad technique, they're not going to be able to execute. But if you top good spacing, Benny, then those liabilities have a higher probability of being successful and not being that black hole. So that's the other thing I would answer your question with is, let's see if we can solve this from a team perspective also.
How do you think, Gary, a parent can discern whether or not a team is really trying to play possession soccer? Because the reality that you see today is that, you know, the best teams that you see at the youth ages consist of, you know, let's say it's 77, seven gifted individual players. And sure, they may connect, you know, 4 or 5 passes in a row and have good sequences, but the truth is they don't have an identity, Gary. I mean, they're just all individually gifted. And do they win games? Of course they do. But is the system that, is it really a possession-based system when you just have 7 players that get the ball and can just take over the game?
Yeah. It's I'm not going to lie. It's getting harder to identify what is a legit possession-based coach versus what isn't. And you just gave one example, because if the team is already very, very good and the roster is head and shoulders above the immediate competition, then just by default, the team is going to hold on to the ball more than the other team and probably play out of the back and do those sorts of things. Because nowadays, kids, let's say it's a U15 team, because nowadays, you know, the 14, 15 year old kid, they see Champions League football, they see international football, they see how the game is played. You know, they see Pat swing it around the back and hold on to the ball and be Manchester City or Real Madrid or Barcelona. They're not dumb. So they'll do it naturally in many cases. And even if the coach is verbally saying, keep the ball, or maybe does a training session or two, the possession, they're going to be able to execute, and the parent is easily fooled. Oh, no, that team keeps the ball. Well, yeah. Well, guess what? If I take the U.S. men's national team, let's say, and then I have them play against a college soccer team, even if the U.S. men's national team is not possession-based, they're going to have possession. Or if I take a U15, you know, top-level team and have it play against middle of the pack or low level U15 team, by default, they're going to have possession. Even if in their own environment, they're constantly launching the ball and losing games like crazy, the superior team is going to have possession. Period. End of story. So how do you discern? That is the question, right, Benny? Well, that's one of the reasons we created the masterclass as well, because the easiest way to discern it is actually being at the training sessions of the coach and seeing what activities are being executed and what's actually being taught. That's number one, okay? Because if the coach is constantly emphasizing this and has drills that develop possession-based football, then you know that the coach has something to do with it, okay? And then if you're not looking at their training, they're just looking at games, it's more difficult. You're going to have to, as a parent or as an observer, be looking off the ball. So don't ball watch. Instead, look at the other players who are not on the ball and what is it that they're doing? What movements are they doing? And if they are doing the things that we teach in the masterclass, like trying to find space, trying to scanning, you know, awareness, all these sorts of things, then you know, okay, it's not an accident as to why this team is playing the way that they're playing. So those are a couple little tips I would give.
And just a quick insert, I think, you know, the choreography of the team's movements is a big way to spot as well. I mean, when the center back gets the ball, is the winger every single time, is he trying to lose his man and put himself in space? Or is it just completely random and they're just, you know, keeping possession of the ball? But the choreography, where do you learn that? It's in the sessions. And if the coach isn't doing those types of activities, then you know, okay, it's just the players. They're just gifted, more gifted than the other team, and they're easily going to be able to keep the ball.
100%. Choreography, choreography, choreography. If you can see that the players are executing certain patterns of play, and again, that's why I mentioned off the ball movement. Yeah. If they're playing it out of the back, you have to look at the outside back. Is he opening up wide to the lane? You know, all these sorts of things. So you hit it on the head. That's a better answer, Benny. If you can identify that there's actual choreography going on, then it's not an accident.
So maybe one of the hardest parts for teams that are playing in a possession-based system is the moments in the final third, right? Maybe a team has 95% possession the entire game, but they can't score, they can't finish. So how can a coach train his team to be able to execute in those moments? It's the hardest part, right?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it, Benny? And that's why strikers and wingers are the most expensive players on the planet. That's why Haaland is worth hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, and that's why Ronaldo and Messi and in their prime were worth hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, that is the final nail in the coffin, if you will, the last little brick on the pyramid. But I would say, you know, in the final third is where you rehearse patterns of play, no problem. So it becomes instinctual how to break down an opponent with one twos to actually penetrate and get in. So that's key to have those repetitions and rehearsals. And don't get it twisted. It's not like the players are sitting there, okay, cool. Let's execute attacking pattern number three. Here we go. No, they naturally just start with muscle memory and brain memory, breaking down the opponent if you actually train it during the week for a long period of time. And then the most important is creativity. That is where you have the least space and time is in the final third, because you might have the entirety of the other team compact in that small, tight area. And you have no space, you have no time. So you have to somehow creatively solve the puzzle. What does that mean? I don't know. Maybe you're going to have the mega guy to get through. Maybe you're going to have to do a scoop pass in the final third to avoid the legs, all the legs that are in the way. That is where the magic happens, Benny. So what can you as a coach do? I don't know. Train the patterns, talk to them. And hopefully you have players that you can encourage, if they don't already do, watch matches religiously and see how opponents do their thing in the final third. So I get that question asked so many times from members in the program, in the coaching program. And I'm like, bro, if I had the one solution, I'd be extremely rich. Nobody has that solution, Benny.
I'm curious, Gary, did you get a chance to watch the U.S. play against Jamaica?
I did not. And we should maybe talk about it a little bit if you want, because I think it's an important thing to discuss and an important thing for parents to be aware of is parents should be watching pro games and they should be aware of what's happening at the professional level, because if you don't know what's happening there, it's going to be difficult for you to properly navigate or guide your kid also, if I'm being frank. So I don't know. Did you watch it?
No. I feel like I'm in the same boat as a lot of other coaches. I mean, the game was at 5 p.m., you know, so I had training. I have it recorded on my DVR, but you know, I haven't had the chance to watch it. But no, Gary, I think that's part of the culture is, you know, especially for parents, you know, have your kids watching, I guess you could call it a high-level game, U.S. versus Jamaica. But, you know, I recently seen a clip on Instagram, I think, and it's a grandma in South America. Maybe you've seen it. And there's like a five-year-old kid. And this was on the bed and she's like throwing balls to him. This kid wants to be a goalie, right? And the grandma's trying to make him become a professional goalie. And the kid is saying like, oh, grandma, like when you're gone, I'm going to be in the pros, you know, looking up to the sky and thanking you for throwing the ball to me every single day, right? But that's the culture. And the highest level players, you know, they eat, breathe and live soccer every single day. And soccer is on TV 24/7 in their house and they always have a ball at their feet, you know, so. I think that's one big way that, and we talked about it, right? Having awareness on the field, your soccer IQ, it goes a long way to watch games and to dissect the games. Not just ball watch the games, but for example, if you're a six, you should be watching the six's movement the entire time, right? Not just when he has the ball, his off the ball movements, where he's at defensively, you know? So I think that's huge. If for parents, if you can get your kids to be watching games, hopefully every single day, I think it goes a long way.
Yeah. Let's end with this, Ben, that you asked about the U.S. game. So if I look at the U.S. versus Jamaica, which was their penultimate game, the game that they played last week, okay, in the first leg, the U.S. won 1-0. They were playing in Jamaica, and the U.S. had 60% possession to Jamaica's 40% possession. Let's fast forward to yesterday's match. The USA won 4-2 here, playing here at home. The U.S. had 68% possession to Jamaica's 32% possession. So what am I trying to say? Okay. Well, I'm clearly trying to correlate possession with winning. Of course, it's terrible to just take one data point or two data point and say, oh, look, there's a correlation here. More possession equals more winning, because that doesn't always happen, especially not at the professional levels, because the game is much, much more rich at the professional level. And there's all kinds of different sorts of tactics to win matches, okay? But the overwhelming amount of time, the team who has the vast majority of possession does win the football matches. Doesn't matter if you look at Champions League, domestic leagues, it doesn't matter what division in the domestic league, the team who has the overwhelming amount of possession, what do I mean by that? Above 60, let's say, because if it's 55-45, that's not kind of like remarkable enough to say, oh, one team totally dominated the other, you know, but if it's above 60%, then you can start having the conversation like, ooh, like clearly this was kind of lopsided. And it could be because of the roster being way more talented. Say that you have Real Madrid versus a second division Spanish team or third division Spanish team, just by default, it's going to happen. But it also could be that the team is being trained to play that way. So I don't know. Some research, I'm sure, has been done on this. I'm going off of my 30 years of watching football, first and foremost, and, you know, anecdotally scanning the stats, you know, over those 30 years as well. If you have the ball, probability goes up that you actually win matches. So it's no wonder that if you are the more talented team isn't going to say, oh, yeah, you know what? I don't want the football. You guys have it. Who does that, Benny? Who actually says, nah, you guys can have the ball, even though we're capable of having it more than you? Not a single fucking team is going to do that. And there's a reason.
Well, really quick, Gary, in the future, do you think the U.S. could compete at the highest levels internationally by, you know, committing to this possession-based approach?
I mean, I think they can already kind of compete. You know, the World Cup is coming in 2026. They have a good coach in Mauricio Pochettino, who has an enormous amount of experience and pedigree at the highest of levels. Argentine international himself, coached the biggest teams in all of Europe, spent a tremendous amount of time in Spain, understands this methodology inside and out, I'm sure. So you have that ingredient. The other ingredient is the preponderance of the U.S. men's national team players now are European-based players who actually are contributors and starters in their first division European clubs at a very high level. So that's another positive note for them. So if you put those two things together, and the World Cup is going to be here in the United States to boot, you can compete, Benny. Is it going to be the methodology that we just described in this episode? I think for the most part, yes. I think Pochettino is going to want to have the ball for sure. I think maybe an exception would be when they run up against like Spain. Pochettino might be like, if we try to play like Spain plays, we might get annihilated. So he might tweak a thing or two and not be so optimistic with trying to win the possession battle with Spain. But aside from that, man, I think we're going to have the ball a lot of the time because the players and the coach that we have did not grow up in this, forgive me, American soccer shit show that we've had for decades. This is a special group, a special generation, because they have not been as contaminated by the American soccer big, fast, and strong philosophy.
Last thing, Gary, it wouldn't be a 3-4-3 podcast without you mentioning promotion relegation somehow. So how does that tie into everything we talked about?
No, thanks for the question, Benny. Maybe we should end all our podcasts with this just so people stick around for the very end. So how is this tied to promotion relegation? Very simple. Promotion relegation, the best teams go up, the worst teams go down. And guess what? The preponderance of teams that are going to win most of the games are going to be the possession-based ones. And so if you had Pro Rel, whatever club technical staff has the best competency in not only teaching possession-based soccer, but identifying the players and the player profiles who are optimal for that, those are the ones that are going to rise up the ranks. And those are the ones who are going to end up, you know, filtering up the ranks all the way to the U.S. men's national team. So we'll be better as a U.S. men's national team. We'll be better in our professional domestic soccer, whether it be MLS, USL, USL League One, all the way down the divisions, if it was open, obviously. We'll be better in the youth soccer landscape because the best youth coaches, best youth clubs, best youth players who are going to go up then. And the ones who go up are the ones who know how to keep the ball. Period. End of story.
Plain and simple.
Not that simple, but it's certainly an important factor. And for those who are skeptics out there, cool, no problem. Just keep considering it is what I would say. You know, keep thinking about it and try to avoid looking at exceptions to the rule, because there's always exceptions to any rule that isn't really mathematics or physics or the hard sciences. You can find exceptions all over the place. I'm sure you can cherry pick data all over the place from all over the world where you had the league champion not own most of the possession, or you had the World Cup champion not own most of the possession, and all these sorts of things. Try to not fall into that trap, because you have to look at the entirety of the landscape to kind of come up with the general rule.
Very good, my friend. You got class today or no?
No class today. I'm just going to, let's see, what did I have planned for today? I think I'm going to do a lot of masterclass work, and then I have a lot of support emails to answer from coaching members. And then after that, I'll probably get back into developing our, you know, the 343 artificial intelligence tool that I've been working on. But that more on that much, much later. We're not close, everybody. So don't get too excited quite yet.
We'll have a whole episode about it when it's ready.
For sure. For sure. All right, Ben. All right, good chat, dude. Good chat.
I'm glad you brought up Jacob Perron today. I miss that one.
Well, we should maybe, I'm sure he'd be open to having a chat with us and recording with us. We can go down memory lane, and I'm sure there's a lot of things that he can teach and lessons learned, and for people to hear from a player like him, you know, and what happened throughout his career and how he did in college, because college soccer is still a thing, obviously.
All right, brother.
All right, man. I'll talk to you later. Thank you, Benny. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.